dear. Yes, it's me again, Jim Brown, with another Outbreak Caper Cast. This is another one of those While I'm Away editions. I'm fixing to head for Florida to survey the damage done to Scrimshaw by the recent Hurricane Maria. You may remember that she was hauled out there at Bellahatchie Marine, Wayne Brown's place in Central Florida. Yeah, another Brown. We're not related, but he's a great old guy. And his super funky little boatyard specializes in dealing with multi-hulls. And in all his many years of operating there, he's never really been hit by a hurricane. So he was getting kind of cavalier about it until it looked like this one was really going to had him in the crosshairs, you know. And for some reason, Wayne really likes the sea runners that have been hauled out there, many of them over the years. And he loves Scrimshaw. He decided he was going to protect Scrimshaw by parking his tractor close aboard on the port side of the boat. And, of course, what happened when the storm came along, the wind came from the starboard side, blew the boat off of its blocks and into the tractor, which kind of crunched up the port float. And Bruce wants to have it fixed. He doesn't want to fix it himself. He doesn't want me to fix it. He's hired a good guy to fix it. So I'm going to go down and have a look and maybe be of some use to the guy that has to do the work. I'll be able to tell you a lot more about it next time we get together. But in the meantime, we have about 8 minutes left of my conversation with Lee Bullock. You'll remember that he's the guy that started up Sausalito Marine back in the 1980s, one of the first all full-service multi-hull boatyards. And in his kaleidoscopic career, he went from maintaining multi-hulls then to building them down in the Caribbean, working with Gold Coast Yachts at St. Croix, and then got into the crew of several of those so-called catamarans, the excursion vessels that are so popular in the tropics. Found himself in the tour business, realized that in order to really make any money at it, he had to get his own boat, and he concluded that the best place to build one was probably down in the Philippines. So he put together a deal down there to build a 55-foot catamaran that was his own design or cobbled together from other designs and his vast experience by now. And he named it Tuco, which is the name of one of their big barking lizards down there in the Philippines. Apparently a lizard woke him up one night because he was snoring too loud, so the lizard crawled up on his bed and barked in his ear, Tuco! That became the name of his boat, and we'll pick up the story from there, but after that, I'll share with you a bit of pretty exciting news, well, let's call it hearsay, that's going on in the modern, super modern yacht biz these days, but first let's hear about Tuco.
I got to tell you one story about Tuco, okay?
Yeah.
We finally got the mast up, and I want to tell you, my dad had a lot to do with this boat. He fought in the Philippines. He came over in the Philippines, and General Fusilero, one of the people that helped me get interface with the schools over there, took him in a PMP helicopter where he fought. And I'll tell you, the Philippine culture is absolutely unbelievably compassionate, and they are just so pure. And it was a perfect place for him to regain his soul. And I think a lot of the Tuco project had something to do with that because we're building it on a beach.
Excuse me, Lee's story gets a little fractured here. His father came to the Philippines, got sick, went to the hospital, became infected, went back to the States, etc.
I'm talking to him on the phone, and he says, well, ask Dean, the foreman, where Toxlumen is. And Dean says, you see that light on the other side of the channel? I said, yeah, that's Toxlumen. I mean, what are the odds of that?
Yeah.
I mean, this guy fought here. He replaced the dead troops when MacArthur came back. And I'm looking at where he landed. And it's just pretty spooky. So
and
it turned out really well. But
Bataan Death March and all of that?
All that was down there. And so the point was, I finally got the mast up while he's in the hospital. And I sent him a picture.
Your dad was in the hospital?
Yeah, he had a simple problem, and it turned into a big problem when because of infection in the hospital, that MERS thing. Yeah, he didn't pass away because of the problem. He passed away because he got exposed in the hospital.
But that was in the Philippines?
No, this is here in the States. I sent him a picture of the boat with the mast up.
Yeah.
And I told him to bring him out of the coma and let him see that this thing is done.
Because
he had a big, he was so proud. And they pulled him out of the coma. He looked at the mast up, and he smiled and winked at my mom, and that was the last time he was out of the coma. But we took that thing out on the first sea trial out the channel. Now, you got to understand this because you're going to appreciate this. We took it out, no plans, all bootleg, bootstrap stuff. We took it out the channel. We got the sail up. We had a reef because it's a huge wing mast, and we had the staysail and the Genoa up. It's a cutter head. And we took off around the point, headed out, I think, 15 miles to the next set of islands. And Nardo, my first mate over there, had sailed around the world double-handed. We're getting maybe 9, 10 knots in a 12-knot breeze, if maybe 15. And I'm pumping it, so you got this curvy railroad track behind you. And Nardo says, well, let's see what you can do. So we trimmed it up, let go of the wheel. It starts doing 12 knots by itself, like, you know, a straight railroad. And I bet him a case of beer that we couldn't get the 15 miles without having to do something. And we went the whole way by itself. I doubled the bet, the case of beer. Now I'm up to 2 cases of beer. And we come back, and I said, it's never going to do this on the way back. You know, all these variables, you can't get it right out the gate. Never have I got it right out the gate. You always have to do something. And this thing not only sailed the straight course back by itself, but we got a lift right at the channel, and it turned down the channel like a horse going back to the barn. I mean, this thing was perfectly balanced, and I'd never, in all the boats I've sea-trialed and repaired and done, never had one done that. And it was just so divine, and you know how hard that is. Yeah, it's very special, and I loved. My juice was that I didn't. You know, it doesn't matter. Like I said before, how much money you've got or how big your boat is. The more you sail, the more you know, and it's all based like Montessori learning system, Montessori's learning format, which is experience-based knowledge. You know it if you do it. You know, you can read all your books, but you don't know it until you do it. So skip the books and just do it. And you'll learn. I mean, that's it. Which ended up being a very big thing for the multi-health center, because when people got boats, usually one I sold before to somebody else, and they wanted it redone for their needs to fit their family or whatever, we would take them during the rebuild process and get them out as often as we could in the demo boats and the boats that were for sale and bamboo.
Ah.
And by the time we rebuilt their boat, they had a crash course of heavy wind, no wind, sand, mud, rock. It didn't matter. We just really shotgun blast their education by experience-based knowledge doing it. And they left, and I still get emails from the people that we rebuilt boats for. They're out there doing it.
Wow.
So they left the bay somewhat ready to see and deal with the world and the conditions out there. That was beautiful. That doesn't happen very often. You can't get that kind of variable on demand for people to learn how to do it. So it was very, very divine in that regard. We really protected a lot of people.
Well, at this point, Lee and I started talking about what a difference it is between sailing in cold water and warm water. It seems like in Northern California, if you're out in a boat, you're cold.
Like I said, it took me almost a year to stop flinching down in the water, down in the Caribbean.
Isn't it wonderful to spend the night on the helm in a bathing suit?
Oh, my God, yeah. And you look down and your toes are tan. I have dreams. I'm looking out at crystal clear, sparkling, you know, Caribbean Gulf Stream water, and I look down, and there's that little froth at the front of the wave as it hits the beach. And when the wave goes out, it's white sand, just like where I sailed, Keneal Bay on St. Thomas. Robin Leach coined that beach as champagne sand, because that's where that came from. And we did that every day, and I dream, and I look down there, and as the wave goes back, my toes are tan again. And, you know, and then when you're in the business, you know, you look at people and you look down, and if they've got Chantos, they're working. They're doing it. You know, and everybody else is just BSing because their toes are white. That's right. We had a thing on the day boat, all the day boats I've been on. We said, tell them, when I like the foredeck, if I can get away from driving, I go to the foredeck, and I love it up there and doing this stuff. And I would explain to the people that if they stay up there all day, they would be honorary members of the Paternal Order of Apus Fordecus. And so when the people that made it all day, you know, on the nets, we would palm, you know how you palm something, a little stick-on gorilla. And we'd say, thanks for coming, and we'd put that on them. And I'd get emails about that years later. They qualify, you know, they cherish that little gorilla because they stayed on the nets all day. Apus fordecus.
Well, I must tell you that this conversation with Lee occurred while he was in a rehab center in Colorado. While he was down in the Philippines with his Tuco catamaran, he got all banged up in an auto crash, came very close to losing his life and losing his leg. He didn't lose either, but he's been through many months of surgeries and recuperation, but he's ready to climb back on the horse.
I got one more little operation, and then 3 months in a weight room, and then I'll take the first option that has anything to do with me walking on water again. So we'll see what happens.
Okay. Hey, hats off to you, Lee.
Yes, indeed. Hats off to Lee Bullock and all of those who have spent substantial portions of their lives to make this modern multi-hull thing happen. But remember that here at Outrig, we're supposed to be about all kinds of lightweight seafaring. And it begins to look like we're in for a whole new chapter when it comes to the modern monohull. I'm sure that some of you have heard that now that New Zealand holds the America's Cup, it's up to them to decide what sort of vessels the next contest will be sailed in. And it looks like they're going to be 75-foot monohulls. But the scuttlebutt is telling me that, they're going to be monohulls unlike anything the world has seen before. And it may be that the good old scow will come around again on the guitar. You know, back in the 1950s and 60s, Yachting Magazine used to put on every year a thing called the Yachting One-of-a-Kind Regatta. They invited boats of all descriptions to show up and have it out on the race course. And for years, those contests were dominated by the so-called Great Lakes scows. They came in several classes, several sizes, and they were shaped like a very shallow, very streamlined barge. Almost rectangular in plan form, what might be called a pram bow, but with a very long overhang pram tapering down to a rather flat underbody that ran all the way to a planing transom. Truly a skimming dish hull form, but a rectangular dish like a butter dish. And these things were equipped with big flat plate centerboards, swing centerboards that really were bilge boards, that is, one on each side of the vessel, pointing diagonally down out through the bilge of the vessel. And in the larger sizes, the same thing with the rudder, twin rudders. So that when going to windward, these vessels were sailed on edge, that is, they'd intentionally get them to heel over as far as possible so as to present an on-edge plank to the waves when going to windward. A very deep, sharp hull form when heeled over. But on off-the-wind or downwind courses, the boats were sailed flat so that they would plane, and they could go like stink. However, I can't remember the year, but I think it was 1954, when a couple of guys showed up with a Bob Harris-designed catamaran called the P-Cat. I think the Pacific Cat was what they called Bob Harris's first real catamaran. Much smaller than the scows, but it cleaned up in the races. And the editors of the magazine were obliged to report And I think I can quote it accurately. They had to say, make no mistake, the fastest sailboat in the world is a good modern catamaran. Of course, this was before the good modern trimaran came along. Now, if the Kiwis were to decide to go back to something like a scow for the upcoming races, it would seem to be a regression. However, today, of course, anything that goes in the America's Cup will probably be equipped with hydrofoils, and I think probably equipped with something like a hybrid wing. So there you have my premature guess as to what kind of a monohull will show up in the next America's Cup contests. It's a premature guess, but one thing we can be sure of is that this monohull is going to be unlike anything the world has ever seen before. There's no doubt it'll be fast. I don't see how it can possibly be faster than the hydrofoiling multi-hulls that have been sailed in the America's Cup. But it might make for races that are more interesting to watch and more fun to sail in. Whether or not it will lead to a true seafaring condition, I have my doubts. The scow is primarily a flat water boat. And of course, when up on a plane, it'd be just like a powerboat. It would pound like a bass drum. But with the addition of hydrofoils, get that hull up out of the water. Well, then let's talk about the rig for this thing. The hybrid wing rig that I've been speaking of is intended, at least initially, for use in multi-hulls. The staying base needs to be very wide so as to lead the rigging from the very top of the wing outboard to make it possible for the rig to have some cord at the very top. And a scow is not nearly as wide as a modern multi-hull. So one is led to consider the notion of a freestanding or unstayed hybrid wing. And this just might be possible in a monohull that has not such extreme initial stability as the multihull. Trying to put unstayed freestanding masts in multihulls leads to having to include a tremendous amount of internal structure to accept the stress concentrations that occur between the deck at the mast partner, where the mast goes through the deck, and then down into the bilge of the vessel to the mast step, where all that stress of the heeling effort versus the righting effort would be concentrated. And that says nothing about the extreme stress placed on the mast itself where it passes through the partner. From there up, just above the deck, there's an enormous amount of bending strain on the mast. Whereas with a stayed rig, the rigging spreads that load out all over the platform, to the point where, in the multi-hull at least, the mast doesn't go through the deck, it's deck-stepped. Furthermore, the unstayed rig in a multi-hull results in enormous prying stresses. Let's say if you put it through the deck of a main hull of a trimaran, that rig is trying to twist the main hull off of the crossbeams. Whereas in the monohull, you're just heeling the hull, which is exactly what the scow requires in order to make it a long, lean, sharp hull for driving to windward. It's heeled over to produce that plank-on-edge shape. And furthermore, in a monohull, the amount of structure in the hull to resist the stresses of the mast partner prying one way and the mast step prying the other way, well, nobody ever goes down into the main hull anyway in a monohull racing scow-shaped vessel. So despite the relatively shallow hull form of the scow, a short distance between the deck and the keel, or the bilge, it would appear quite possible to get enough berry, as it's called, how deep the mast or the wing is embedded into the boat, possible to get enough berry to accommodate the structural loads of an unstayed hybrid wing in a scow-shaped vessel. Of course, when the scow heels way over, it spills much of its energy out the top of the sail, so there would be a temptation to try to arrange for a so-called canting mast. Go ahead, heel the vessel over in order to achieve that plank on edge, but incline the mast to windward. Get it more or less straight up and down so it's still delivering some power. Well, at that point, it looks like to me it'd be easy to capsize a scow because the sail is not spilling its power out the top caused by heeling. But let's not forget the hydrofoils. The downwind hydrofoil just might provide enough stability at that time, even though the vessel was heeled hard enough to get the upwind hydrofoil out of the water. The thing still might have enough stability to avoid having to put a great big ballast keel on the bottom. Nevertheless, a ballast keel of some description might be very useful if, at times, it could be canted to windward. That is, the canting keel concept might be combined with all these other features. Well, you can think about all that stuff until you get dizzy, but it looks to me like those who designed the new boats for the America's Cup, defense by the Kiwis, has got plenty of opportunity these days that they did not have just a few years ago when monohulls in the America's Cup were abandoned because it was like watching grass grow. I don't think it'll be that way again. And what comes out of this just might really be something new under the sun. Very well, oh patient listener. Thank you for listening. Thank you for coming. Hope you come again. Bye-bye. Thank you.